I'm Christopher Lydon with David Shields, literature's manifesto man for the digital age. The question to which he has offered 618 answers in an irresistible book called Reality Hunger is roughly this. Who is going to write the stories that the world will remember about these times? Stories for the cell phone. Stories about a YouTube culture. Who will read the stories of this age? Who will own them? Will they be long or short? Will they be fact or fiction? This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. We call it an American conversation with global attitude. This one is with the author and provocateur David Shields. This book of his, Reality Hunger, is a catalog of aphorisms to fight about. Number 501, every man has within himself the entire human condition. That is borrowed from the immortal essayist, Shakespeare's contemporary Montaigne. Number 63, lifted from Robert Winder, asks, how can we enjoy memoirs, believing them to be true, when nothing, as everyone knows, is so unreliable as memory? Number 260, good poets borrow, great poets steal, generally attributed to T.S. Eliot. Or number 261, Picasso's line, art is theft. Or number 262, which is David Shields' own, why is hip-hop stagnant right now? Why is rock dead? Why is the conventional novel moribund? Because they're ignoring the culture around them, where new, more exciting forms of narration and presentation are being found or rediscovered. David Shields, welcome to Open Source and welcome back to Brown.
Thank you, Christopher.
1978, if I'm right.
That's right. I graduated in 78, 32 years ago. And much of my current artistic gestures, it seems to me, are related to things I studied at Brown. Namely, we were urged to mash things up. We certainly didn't call it that then. But I was, for a while, a semiotics major, and then I became an English literature major. And, you know, I was hugely influenced by Robert Scholes here, who was doing terrific semiotic analysis there, you know, reading Roland Barthes as cross-wiring it with Ernest Hemingway. And so many of my gestures in which I want to merge the critical and the creative, the factual and the fictive comes from me studying at Brown when all this stuff was at its height, that a lot of the French post-structuralists were being taught here and the new curriculum was in its flowering. And we were urged to see everything in terms of everything else, that art was in juxtaposition, both the curriculum as the work that we read and the work that we tried to write. So it took me a while because I began as a relatively traditional novelist, but finally the Brown ethos caught up with me.
I'm struck also by the connection with open source and why we call this program open source. It's built on the notion, sort of reinforced by computer programming, that nobody owns anything, certainly not in the realm of art or opinion. And we're all better off if these things are shared, that intellectual property may be a perfect oxymoron.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of my favorite passages in the book, which is from William Gibson, which I don't cite because he is so against copyright that I thought it would be a total transgression to cite him. Who owns the words? Who owns the music? And the rest of our culture. We do, all of us, though not all of us know it yet. That's the book. I mean, that's open source. I mean, this book is practically a love letter to open source. Watch me take all this material from, you know, classical literature to contemporary text, from the newspaper, from theory, from every possible source, and watch me, by remixing it, curiously make it my own. I stand, you know, absolutely behind this book as an articulation of my own aesthetic. There was a review by James Wood in the New Yorker of the book that was somewhat skeptical, who said it's not clear sort of what Shields thinks. Well, everything I put in the book, I believe in. It doesn't really matter if Melville said it or Bud Powell said it. I put it in the book. I've edited it. I've placed it in the position I want. I'm trying to suggest how an open source art can look for the next century.
All art is borrowing. Bach got a lot of those dance rhythms out of North African music, and who knew? but who's to take it away either?
Well, it's a lot of what I'm arguing is that the art of the 21st century is an art of plagiarism, but I also want to argue that from the beginning of time, artists plundered from each other, that art from the beginning of time has been theft. Two-thirds of Shakespeare's Henry VI is derived directly from Plutarch's Lives. Montaigne's essays are heavily a tissue of quotes and cribs from Latin authors.
Why did he not feel compelled to cite everything?
It's a good point. Why do we now in this litigious culture want to wrap Ian McEwan's knuckles when he took 170 words from a nurse's journal for a novel, but Montaigne would have cascades of passages from Ovid and Tacitus and Terence, etc.? Part of it, of course, was learning. There was an assumption that his readers would know the passages. But a good example of it is Theodore Adorno's Minima Moralia, which when published in German was published without citations, and sadly when published in the UK and the US came adorned, no pun intended, with citations. And the whole work gets domesticated, denuded, denatured, and made less risky, less discomforting and nervous-making. And the result is the reader has handrails, toeholds, you know, where you say, oh, I get it. I know where everything is from. To me, when you pull that out, you're in this open source world in which you're not so concerned with the provenance of who said it. You're following the argument of what's being said. And obviously, my book is an attempt to accelerate that movement so that in contemporary art, contemporary music, contemporary painting, and I want contemporary literature to catch up with the other arts.
So we begin to think of you as a sort of DJ Spooky of literature here. Mix and mash, put it on the turntable and see what goes with what.
A little bit. I mean,
him dance anyway?
Yeah, I mean, I think the evolution of this book is perhaps of interest. I began this book, believe it or not, as a course packet. I started as a fiction writer, became a nonfiction writer. I needed to teach myself and my students why nonfiction was such an exciting art to me. It wasn't journalism. It wasn't scholarship. It was capable of the highest reaches of literary art. I developed a compendium of thousands of quotations from other people that were my sort of life raft, my sort of talking points to myself as regards why nonfiction is so deeply interesting to me on an existential and philosophical level, that the very nonfiction frame gets you into great philosophical questions such as what's true, what's knowledge, what's memory, what's a self, what's reality, and that
you leave out what's a good story.
I'm terribly interested in stories, but I'm wary of work whose entire raison d'etre is story itself. For instance, I'm a huge fan of a so-called novel by J.M. Coetzee called Elizabeth Costello, which is a great, great book, I think. But the motor of that book is thought. The motor is not sheer narrative energy. And so I'm a huge devotee and champion of works that are using story as one of its many tools, but whose entire purpose is not simply to keep the reader turning pages, as many highly praised middle-brow novels are.
For example?
Well, two of my bete noirs are Ian McEwan and Jonathan Franzen. I sort of use them because I guess they're relatively easy and large targets. You know, they're highly praised and commercially successful writers whose work bore me beyond tears. They're antiquarians to me. They're writers. They're entertaining the troops as the ship goes down. I mean, they're just utterly devoted to a 1910 version of the novel, you know, pre-James Joyce, essentially. And to me, it's just pure nostalgia that people find such works of interest. It's essentially an escape from the thrillingly vertiginous nature of contemporary existence to retire and retreat into the cocoon of a well-made novel.
David Shields, there are so many arguments here and so little time, but I want to get right to the point of your idea of art for the 21st century. the art that will do some sort of justice to the weirdness that we all live with and make good use, constructive, independent use of the technologies that are now available. I mean, what would it look like? What would it sound like? What are your ideals out there?
Well, to me, it would, first of all, obliterate distinctions between fiction and nonfiction. That's game plan one. Second plan for me is to overturn or at least override and review our notions regarding appropriation and copyright. And third, the implication of all this is that we create new forms for a new century, that artists from the beginning of time have plundered and plagiarized each other, as I indicated earlier. Montaigne, Shakespeare, Kathy Acker, Burroughs, James Joyce, and everyone in between.
Right, as we assume that architects and musicians and all sorts of other creative people do too.
Exactly. For instance, Maya Lin's Vietnam War Memorial is a direct translation and, in a way, plagiarism of classical funereal statuary, that she had been studying this material in a graduate course with Vincent Scully in the Yale Graduate Architecture Program. And is she plagiarizing? No, she's doing what artists have done from the beginning of time, remake other people by misreading them. That's what artists have done from the beginning of time. And a lot of the argument of my book is precisely this. Given that art and plagiarism are amazingly synonymous, and given the wealth of material available to us digitally at the click of a button, it seems to me absolute suicide for artists to subscribe to the copyright laws now in operation. And my book is obviously an attempt to put a foot in the door and try and push things forward so that we take art away from the lawyers and return it to artists, he said naively.
Well, three cheers. Although you do bow to your own publisher's lawyers by citing at the end the real authors of a lot of the wisdom that you've included. I've puzzled about this, and I'd love to abolish the whole idea of copyright. But who would lose in that turn? I've rationalized it in terms of pop music, for example, where those wars have been intense, that the new artists don't need copyright on their published stuff because the wider the circulation, the bigger their stadium audiences get. Does that apply to literature?
In a way. I mean, I think it's hard. I haven't worked out all of the implications, how it's all going to happen. It seems to me obvious, I hope, that in 20 years, if not less, there will not be publishers. It's hard to believe there will be these brick buildings with brick and mortar and someone will take a book, publish it in a warehouse, send it to New Jersey, send it to Denver on the off chance that a Denver bookstore wants three copies. When no one wants it, mail those books back to the New Jersey warehouse. It's just a completely irrelevant model. We can all print out books at the click of a button from our own computers, from our own laptops, from our own cell phones. And so it seems to me that increasingly artists are going to own copyright to their own work. I thought long and hard about publishing this book myself through Kinko's. Part of me wishes I did. A British publisher wanted to publish this book as a series of tweets. And to my surprise and embarrassment, I said no. But you know, we're all trying to figure it out, myself among them. And this book is an attempt to accelerate that moment where we have to decide.
The collapse of the old institutions, publishing houses, networks, newspapers is all around us. But what fascinates me is how the content, the subject, the audience, the every definition of art is being changed even before it gets to the publisher. And I'd love you to spell that out. What is the reality hunger that's not being met in the world today?
Somehow the remix is what we want. There's a wonderful line in my book by Adam Gopnik where he talks about something that is really a beautiful statement of the kind of art that I think that we're talking about. And Gopnik says, It may be that this is number 365 in your hymnal. It may be that nowadays, in order to move us, abstract pictures need, if not humor, then at least some admission of their own absurdity, expressed in genuine awkwardness or in an authentic disorder. Gee, those are marching orders for me. That is awfully good. And so these people who write either the McEwans and Franzes of the world, they are not writing with humor or authentic disorder or genuine awkwardness. Those, to me, are the opposition.
Talk about some of the literary practitioners. I mean, if Ian McEwan and Jonathan Franzen are the enemy, so to speak, who are the heroes? Who are the friends? Who's doing it?
Well, I feel that my book is a series of odes to people who I think are indeed doing it. Someone who comes to mind who might be not sufficiently well-known except among the cognoscenti is David Markson, who's had a huge influence on my work. The four books I'd urge people to read are This Is Not a Novel, Reader's Block, Vanishing Point, and The Last Novel. And his techniques are heavily influenced me, that his works are presented as novels, and yet all they are essentially are tissues of quotations, some cited, some not. There is no narrative energy in the works. There's immense intellectual and emotional momentum. For instance, This Is Not a Novel is a book that is absolutely a laser focus on, against the fact that we die, what solace, if any, is there in art itself? The fact that, the fact that we die, to what degree can we offer any consolation through art? You know, it's a series of 600 passages from Markson, from everyone else about that very topic. And I find that kind of work absolutely thrilling. It's actually about something. It's actually trying to do what I call solve being alive. It actually worries some huge conundrum in the human canon. And so I would say David Markson is a major literary hero for me.
It also satisfies your criterion that literature sort of explode on every page. It's not like waiting for something to happen endlessly or endless focus on the long arc of narrative, but energy, energy, energy.
Exactly. That's a huge focus for me.
That's a bit of a neurotic modern need, though, isn't it?
Is it sort of attention deficit disorder?
Exactly. I mean, I love it too.
Right. No, I agree. I mean, it's hard to know whether this is just me because I'm impatient, I don't have enough time, or whether I'm actually helping to forge a new aesthetic. All I can say, it's the work that I genuinely love. Works like Maggie Nelson's Bluets or Amy Fusselman's The Pharmacist's Mate. Sarah Manguso's The Two Kinds of Decay, some of Nicholson Baker's work. I mean, all of these.
Do we get Zadie Smith on Beauty or White Teeth in there?
To me, absolutely not. Absolutely not. I mean, to me, Zadie Smith's essays I like quite a bit. She has a brand new book called Changing My Mind, I believe it's called. And there's some terrific essays in that book. But to me, as a novelist, she's pretty much of the old school, in my view, that her material is rather contemporary, but her approach is, to me, deeply Dickensian, and to me, she's not a useful model.
Well, we part company there, but let's talk about Nicholson Baker, whom I adore. Is he a novelist?
Well, I'm always trying to kidnap him as a nonfiction writer. To me, the book, his most recent book, The Anthologist, has some passages.
We talked to them about it. Love it.
I love the book. And I love Baker. I love Baker's work. He's a major influence on my work. The Anthologist, to me, is a useful book to talk about. There are passages in there that are as good as anything Baker has ever written, that are as tender, as funny, as smart, as provocative. In my view, though, that work is hamstrung by the fact that Nicholson Baker has to pretend that he's writing a novel. In no way for me is that book really a novel. The novelistic gestures in the book, especially the last half, feel to me extremely left-handed, extremely, I mean, no offense to your left-handed listeners out there. I mean, it just feels very pro forma. He doesn't care about the narrative. What Nick Baker wants to do in that book is meditate on the sources and implications of poetry. There's this really lame plot about giving a speech at a conference and getting back with his ex-girlfriend, and it's all very predictable and very weak. In a similar way, in DeLillo's new novel called, I think, Point Omega, Omega Point, the origin of that book for DeLillo was that he saw a film called 24-Hour Psycho in which a visual artist slowed Hitchcock's Psycho down so that you have to watch it over 24 hours. And DeLillo went to the Guggenheim and watched the film many times, was absolutely riveted by it, as am I. DeLillo wanted to write a meditation on that film. The best parts of the book by far are DeLillo's meditations on 24-Hour Psycho. That's the book that DeLillo really wanted to write. But instead, feeling this old appendage called novelist impulse, he wraps it around a rather uninspired novelistic framework. And I'm trying to urge novelists, throw away your chains, write the books you really want to write. You know, I was a fiction writer, and I have less by far of a novelistic imagination than either DeLillo or Baker, but I'm trying to urge people to write the 90-page essay on 24-Hour Psycho that DeLillo really wanted to write. You know, why do films always have to be exactly an hour and 40 minutes? Why couldn't a film be, 30 minutes and be the best film of the year? I'm hugely drawn toward apparently brevity, compression, concision. Nietzsche said, I want to say in 10 sentences what everyone else says in a book, or rather, what everyone else doesn't say in a whole book. There's something about the very nature of compression and concision that forces a kind of raw candor, and that interests me a lot.
Come back to Nick Baker's method, though. You owe something to him and his book, Human Smoke, in the way he assembled a history of the use of weapons of mass destruction in the 20th century, from Iraq, oddly enough, under the Brits in the 20s to World War II. It was all a compilation of letters, headlines, newspaper stories, memoirs, scenes. And it did explode on every page. It was incredibly powerful, both in the detail and in the overall argument. What does that tell you about pastiche or a different sort of narrative, a kind of documentary or pseudo-documentary, looks like documentary form?
It's a fascinating book. I'm not interested. I'd be a total hypocrite to argue who influenced whom. My book was done by the time that Human Smoke came out. So that particular book didn't influence me. A lot of Baker influenced me, but not Human Smoke. Human Smoke is an amazing book that looks to the casual reader as if Nicholson Baker just cranked through a lot of microfilm and presented a kind of quasi-journalistic history, largely through the New York Times of World War II. But if you read it at all carefully, that you see, it's Baker's argument. It's essentially a pacifist argument against war. That Baker's, I believe he's a Quaker or was a Quaker, and that he wants to argue. Baker set for himself the challenge, I want to argue against all war. What's the toughest case to make? I'll argue against World War II and see if I can make the case. And he used this as a way to argue for, the deeply military aspects of Churchill and Roosevelt and how unconscionable a lot of the things they did. And it's an extraordinary book in which Baker, by tilting the passages in such a way, cutting them off in a certain way, juxtaposing them in a certain way, I would just say something like it's the way that we write now. There's an incredibly interesting passage in my book that I'm tempted to quote here by a former student of mine who says this, and it goes exactly to what you're saying, Christopher. I'm finding it harder to just quote write. The seeking and sculpting of found text or sound have become my primary quote artistic function. Actually generating that text or music seems increasingly difficult. Lately, I'll sit down with a blank pad and feel like I really have to dig down deep to get my own voice to come out over the quote sample choir. It's a very strange feeling, like a conductor trying to sing over the orchestra, and is, I believe, a fairly new one for artists. That I think that Baker would never have written that book 20 years ago or even perhaps 10 years ago. And I think that my former student, Brian Christian, captures it awfully well. There are people who read that or hear that and just say, stop being so lazy, find your own voice, write like Ford Madox Ford. And what I want to argue, what my book argues, and what a lot of fellow travelers argue, is that we simply can no longer write that way anymore.
Why not?
Well, that's a good question. It's something that you feel at a fairly visceral level. Part of it is the individual, in my view, doesn't exist the way that he once existed. That we have a skepticism about the glory and beauty and the independence of the individual. That we understand that we're barcoded, that we're DNA'd up, that we're part of a huge bureaucracy, and that, you know, the scintillating nature of the single voice strikes me as a kind of fiction now. Second of all, we have at our fingertips this immense amount of material instantaneously. I mean, now it seems to me the individual has been deconstructed, for lack of a better word, as part of this huge wash of culture and of digitization and access and a series of voices.
Fascinating. You know, I love the new technology and I fight it too. For example, I've been thinking for years about writing about my father, dead 40 years, very powerful person, even though he was completely disabled by Parkinson's disease every day that I knew him for 30 years. In any event, I imagine this kind of artistic reconstruction of all my experience and emotion and blah, blah, blah. On this 40th anniversary, under pressure from my siblings, I just started assembling every kind of memory, fragments, photographs, letters, jokes, a lot of jokes, sports stories, whatnot, and found I had sort of what I wanted all along.
There you go. Join the parade. That's it. That is it for me, that the assemblage. I got in a bit of an argument with my friend Jonathan Lethem about this, where he was talking about, you know, it was a friendly argument that we're very much supporters of each other's work and friends and colleagues and inspirations, I hope, to each other. But he said that he just loves accumulating stuff and said, but that finally is not the real work. And I'm saying, yes, it is. That in the hands of a master collage artist, the assemblage can be the real work. It often is not. That I write in the book, collage is not a refuge for the compositionally disabled. It's an evolution beyond narrative. Just the fact that you, Christopher, have assembled all this material doesn't mean that it's a book yet. It may. You have to rearrange stuff in such a way that it has immense emotional and thematic power. It's the assemblage that interests me quite a bit.
I'm going to bring it to your class. But now here's the Orhan Pamuk digression. He's a novelist of the old school in a certain sense. I mean, child of Dostoevsky, of Nabokov, of Tolstoy. But he's also, especially in My Name is Red, I mean, he's assembled so many different elements, visual and historical and fantastical and whatnot. In his lectures up at Harvard last fall, which I found endlessly interesting, he was comparing all novels, including his new one, The Museum of Innocence, to museums. And he's built a museum to correspond to the novel. It's going to be all the stuff, cigarette butts and wine glasses and date books and matches and all sorts of things that he associated with the love affair in the novel. There's assemblage, collecting, you know, stuff. And he would say that that is the story of the modern novel. That's only to say that there's something old and new about all of these arguments. What's the new part for you?
The new part for me is I recently tried to reread Lolita, and I found that I was much more interested in Alfred Appel's notes in the back of the book than I was in the actual novel. It seems to me I was interested in his scribbles, in his marginalia, in his scratching on the book, whereas the work itself, the sort of monumental work, the sort of totemic modernist novel, I mean, I happen not to like the novel very much. I think it's in many, many ways a really bad book. But to me, it was a really interestingly revelatory moment for me that for me, in a sort of post-postmodern world, it's the footnotes I want. It's the graffiti. It's the citations. That it's too late for masterpieces. You know, no more masters, no more masterpieces. That's the feeling. That's the moment that we're in. You might say that's sad or that's humble, but there's something sort of winningly modest and winningly human and winningly nervy about work that knows the space that we're in now and knows that we're in a period of scratching.
I want to fight back on that. That's surrendering to Twitter dimensions, it seems to me, or to short spans of attention or to screen culture. And artists have got to do precisely the opposite. To me, it's a question of whether how you use the technology without being made a monkey by it.
I see what you mean, that I don't want to get in bed with, say, you know, Ashton Kutcher and his tweeting of his every dental appointment. That's not really what I'm about. I'm about taking the energy of contemporary culture and finding in it the resources for a new literature. I mean, people ask me why I publish this between covers rather than as, you know, a Twitter feed or as I don't know what. I mean, I believe in books. I love books to death. I want to renew the novel. I wanted to take the energy of contemporary culture and find a way to make it relevant for the next century. And so I feel like that my book is a deeply patterned book. It has
meaning.
A lot. It's really, you know, a carefully organized book that has real momentum and real movement to it.
David Shields, I'm wondering what are the implications here for something called high art as opposed to the pop and the everyday. It reminds me of Philip Roth joking about a conference in Iowa in the 50s, must have been, but they imagined then that the score was roughly high art 7, pop art 4. It's now 8 trillion for pop art, and high art is gasping for dear life. Are you surrendering something here?
I don't know about that. I mean, I think I would argue that my book is, I hope, a work of high art. I mean, a lot of the work I love, whether it's Sarah Silverman or Chris Rock or Larry David, are approximately pop art, or, you know, they're kind of an acquired taste. And then a lot of the writers I really love are the most amazing works of exquisite art ever performed, whether it's Lawrence Stern or Melville or Proust or J.M. Coetzee, are the most exquisite expressions of the human animal one could possibly imagine. To me, I'm interested in totally demolishing the hierarchies. I'm interested in work that does what I call solve. It shows you how the writer solved being alive. And I find that as present in Chris Rock's Bring the Pain as I find it in Rousseau's Confessions. I like work that puts that question at the heart of the work. And I don't care whether it's St. Augustine or whether it's, you know, it's Wayne Kostenbaum. It's that is what I want from art. I'm very aware that we are mortal. I have no consoling religions, no consoling gods, that we are existentially alone on the planet. We can't know what each other is thinking and feeling. I want art that builds a bridge across that abyss.
I locate this book, David Shields, at a sort of moment when Jaron Lanier, famously, and others are really kind of rethinking this digital adventure we're into and having lots of doubts about individuality, you know, responsibility, not to mention ownership and property. I mean, we've seen in the journalism business, for example, the destructive power of the internet on big institutions. I think there's much more than equal value coming out of the liberation of individual voices. But where do you put yourself in this kind of, 10 years at least into an internet culture, the misgivings out there?
Maybe it's an East Coast, West Coast thing a little bit. I've lived the majority of my life on the West Coast, and maybe I'm sort of prejudiced toward electronic and digital and web culture because it was created on the West Coast in Seattle and San Francisco. And I'm interested in the disillusion of the self, only to find the self at deeper levels. And so I hope I'm not being a sort of naive surrenderer to it. And I see your point and I take your skepticism, but it's sort of...
I'm voicing other people's skepticism.
It's sort of like pushing back against oxygen. I mean, are you in favor of oxygen? It's the air that we breathe now. You can be for it or against it. It's irrelevant. It is the world that we occupy. And I mean, it just simply dominates. It is the culture that we live in. And basically, both that we as citizens and we as artists better figure out a way to live with it and transform it rather than to say, shudder, shudder, it's awful. I'm going to write a Jonathan Franzen novel. That much I know. That is definitely not the solution.
You have a wonderful line in here. I'm not sure I can find it, but about the West as being a basically much freer place than the East, still into its own sort of ancestor worship and tradition. I want to be with you out there. and I feel hugely liberated, even personally, having done – I mean, my own professional life has been a kind of progress or regress out of institutional journalism into finding my own voice on radio, hearing other people's voices coming back, opening up on the internet. I work entirely – for myself, thanks to the Watson Institute, and I love it, and I don't mourn any of these fallen false gods of, you know, committee journalism or Tom Brokaw really knows what's going on. But I guess I want to. What is it? I feel still attached to. It's genius, great works, Proust, a lot of the same things that you honor.
Yeah, I'm all for genius. I'm all for great works. They're not going to be written the way – I mean, great works by definition are iconoclastic in that they literally break the icons of the past. When people first heard Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, they ran screaming out of the aisles. The first time they saw Monet, they didn't know what they were looking. The first time they heard, you know, Webern and Schoenberg, they were appalled. I mean – great works, by definition, demolish the past. I mean, there's the epigraph of the book is, or one of the three epigraphs is from Walter Benjamin, who says, all great works of literature either dissolve a genre or invent one. That, you know, is tattooed to my forehead. I mean, that is, that's an essential line. And yes, I love Proust. I read Proust in graduate school. It remains for me probably the signal reading experience of my lifetime. That was written in 1922. It's almost 100 years ago. If you were to honor Proust, you would break as fully from the literature of the past as Proust did from the literature surrounding him. I mean, he was writing against Anatole France. I mean, art, like science, moves forward. Art progresses. It does not worship the ancestors of the past.
I'm with you in your Proustolatry. Another author we love is William Gibson in Vancouver, out your way, the man who invented the phrase cyberspace. He writes in a piece you've quoted here that we live basically in a world that's the opposite of broadcast. The distribution economics of the internet favor infinite niches, not one size fits all. I guess I want to push back at the idea that a technology, a chance invention, should be telling us exactly what and how to think, who to talk with, who to respect, what to be reading.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that would be preposterous. It strikes me as a tool and not an autocrat. One would have to be more of a Marxist than I am to believe that it's telling me how to think.
Are there works of old, I mean, going way back to Homer even, that you appreciate in a new way from a kind of web head that you see their making or appreciate their depth in ways you hadn't before?
So many works like that. I mean, I love Moby Dick to death. It's to me essentially, it's not really a novel for me. It's essentially a meditation. It's Melville's meditation on godlessness. It's Melville trying to articulate the absence of God. After writing it, Melville wrote to Hawthorne and said, I've written a wicked book and feel as spotless as the lamb. That should be the goal for every writer. You know, so that book I see as one huge, you know, Webhead's meditation on a godless universe. That's that book. Tristram Shandy, I love quite a bit. Lawrence Stern's novel. And I love a lot of early writers like Rochefoucauld's Maxims. I love Blaise Pascal's Pensées. I love the aphorists quite a bit. You know, the writers of short aperçus. So I would say Nietzsche, Pascal, Rochefoucauld, Stern, and Melville are giants to me. And you could see them as, in a way, I mean, this will sound absurd, but they're kind of bloggers, you know? I mean, they're writing down stuff. But they happen to be great bloggers. I mean, they're great. It'd be like if every tweet that you got was this amazing aphorism from Nietzsche. I want work that is that good because we are impatient. We are mortal. We want the wisdom now. And the work I love, whether it's, you know, Amy Fusselman's The Pharmacist's Maid that was written in 2000 or Pascal's Pensées that were written, I don't know, 1680 or something, they all have the same energy. We're here on the planet. Let's try to figure out a little bit about our existence. I'm going to tell you how I solve being alive right now. So listen up.
You know, another of our joint heroes, if I may presume to say, David Shields, is Ralph Waldo Emerson. Talk about a writer who explodes unpredictably in every other sentence, every ninth sentence, every fourth page, a man who's blogging all the time. To me, I call him the god for bloggers. He, again, go with your gut. Follow the gleam of in your own mind from within. Trust thyself. Put it down. Change your mind tomorrow, but get it down. That wonderful line, Harold Bloom's favorite. We confront every work of genius hearing and seeing the fruits of our own mind coming back with a certain alienated majesty.
It's incredible.
I think Emerson might be among the most cited, most appropriated writers in your book.
I quote Emerson constantly, perhaps as many as 10 or 12 times.
What does that tell us?
That Emerson was terribly alert to questions of quotation, appropriation, and citation. He was an inveterate quoter. He had a huge influence on Nietzsche.
But he also said, I hate quotation. Tell me what you think.
Right. Well, that's a bit ironic, I think. I mean, he was an immense quoter, and he also was an amazing sentence maker. He believed in the sentence as the unit of thought, as do I. I mean, and also he—
As did Nabokov, as did George Orwell, I think.
Yeah, but Emerson practiced it better than they did, in my view. I mean, certainly better than Nabokov. You know, in no way am I worshiping, I hope, a false contemporary god. Emerson can be practicing it as well as Pascal, as well as, you know, as Nicholson Baker. There's definitely, in a way, this book is an attempt to recover a line of thought going from St. Augustine to, you know, Joan Didion. And Emerson is a crucial stop on that path. Mm. As a sentence maker, as somebody who is using himself as a sort of theme carrier, as the host of humanity, someone who sees in himself everything that plays out through humanity, and who above all perhaps wasn't a novelist. He wasn't a dramatist. He believed in the essay. He believed in the essay in the French sense, the essay as a try, as an attempt, as a trial, experiment, perhaps fail. And he's terribly good at seeing himself as a theme carrier, as a symbolic persona, and also, above all, at laying himself extraordinarily bare, extraordinarily naked, of saying the most embarrassing taboo things about himself and trusting the reader to acknowledge the same things about himself. Incredible line I quote from Emerson in the book. He says, "The way to write is to throw the body at the mark when all your arrows are spent." Gee, that's awfully good to me. I mean, where it really emphasizes the existential rigor of serious writing, how deeply vulnerable, how deeply naked and rigorous and exposed good writing is. It's almost physical, the sense of self-exposure in the best work.
You're down on novelists David Shields. And I just want to say, sort of in their defense, I pine for more novelists. I love Zadie Smith. I miss Norman Mailer. I miss John Updike. I miss the prophetic novelists, those novelists like, you know, John Dos Passos at one point, I suppose, who – Victor Hugo is my best example of novelists of a nation who tell you where we're going. We embody the idea of the French Revolution, what's up in the 1850s or whatever. Melville in that same category too. I think we're starving for people with a general sense of the American idea in the 21st century. At the same time, just thinking about them, I realized that the ones I love most are that sort of assimilative. I mean, Victor Hugo, that wasn't a novel either, Les Miserables. It was his blog about Napoleon, about Waterloo, about religion, about God, about salvation, about poor people, about exile. And it was kind of his notebook, a la Montaigne, almost. But I guess maybe the models for me that I don't want you to sort of run over are Salman Rushdie today. I'm reading Midnight's Children with infinite pleasure. I don't know how you feel about that. And also Orhan Pamuk. I mean, I think he's representative of that whole discovery of novelists by people in countries we never heard of before. Who knew about Istanbul? But we all do now.
By no means do I come to bury Caesar, but to resurrect him. I mean, I'm not here to bury the novel. I'm here to renew it. Mm. I'm here to, you know, I happen not perhaps to share your admiration of certain writers. Updike means almost nothing to me other than as countermodel. Writers who are figuring out a way to obliterate distinctions between genre and open up possibilities of mixing documentary with confession, with reportage, with fiction, with ripped headlines to create something that feels more contemporary in its channel-changing modality as opposed to paying incredible obeisance to the novelistic models of yore.
Your attack on the notion that plagiarism is a big sin fascinates me. Maybe 10 years ago, a guy I knew well, Alexander Theroux, got nailed for plagiarism in a book on the primary colors, a book that must have had 1,000 citations of sources, a very sort of all-knowing survey like yours, in which he had said something about the Yellow River in China, which turned out to have been definitely lifted from somebody's forgotten manuscript from the 1930s. It made page one of the New York Times. And I thought, there's something spooky here. There's some deep taboo, maybe constructed by the publishing industry, but it's as bad as child molestation or as incest in this culture we've been living in. I wonder if we're breaking out of it, but I also wonder, what was that taboo all about?
I think it's a great question, and it's in a way a lot of the origins of my book can be derived to my immense frustration over the scandals du jour that were happening a few years ago with, you know, James Frye and Margaret Seltzer and Dave Fonseca and Wilmer Riss.
Going back to Wilmer. Martin Luther King and all sorts
yeah.
of people that
it's endless.
Are remembered as plagiarists.
Yeah,
who cares?
We endlessly are vetting nonfiction as if it were a subset of journalism, as if it were an article in the New York Times. It has to be vetted for its supposed accuracy. Whereas this other tradition called the lyric essay or literary nonfiction that goes back millennia. I mean, in Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian Wars,
yes.
Thucydides makes up the general speeches. That seems to me a crucial thing to understand about nonfiction. Thomas de Quincey in Confessions of an English Opium Eater is a largely fictional account of his addiction to and recovery from opium. All of Orwell's classmates question virtually every detail of his great essay, Such Were the Joys. Nonfiction, from its very origins, has been confused and confusing fiction and fact from the very beginning. Nonfiction, to me, is a framing device to foreground contemplation. Memory is a dream machine. Composition is a fiction-making operation. You know, the moment that we write, we are remaking the world, and it's a child's version. It's a lawyer's version to see nonfiction as somehow incontrovertibly true. And if we ever catch you at it, we're going to to wrap you across the knuckles, and it's deeply invested in journalism's attempt to colonize the truth, to colonize reality, and print it as fact.
Oh, man, that's well said. And then the empire struck back. I mean, there in the Sunday New York Times was Michiko Kakutani, longtime book reviewer, saying that David Shields' book, Reality Hunger, was deeply nihilistic, representative of a sort of cut-and-paste ethic, appropriation art. What did you make of that?
Well, I felt like, frankly, Robert Mapplethorpe being criticized by Jesse Helms, you know, that if Michiko Kakutani wanted to play Jesse Helms to my Robert Mapplethorpe, I'm thrilled. What to say? I mean, I must admit I had trouble reading it. I looked at it, I perused it. It seemed to me virtual self-parody of the powers that be holding on desperately, sadly, pathetically, with a total absence of logic to its last straws of power. I mean, for me, I guess I would start with the idea that I gathered that the one of her critiques was the idea that the book was, God forbid, trying to gather attention. I mean, to me, the comedy of writing a 3,000 or 5,000 word article that leads with me and ends with me and then criticizes the book for gathering attention. I mean, you can't grant attention and simultaneously lambast the book for gathering attention. I just put the book together. If the book has gathered attention, that's neither my fault nor my accomplishment. Deeply nihilistic was, I think, the other critique from the reviewer. Wow, that's the last thing the book is. I mean, I'm open to all sorts of critique. I've learned from all sorts of reactions to the book. I've really enjoyed engaging with students and professors and critics and bloggers about the book. I have no claim on being right or God or anything. But one of the things I say about the book is that I really love works that have as their crux an investigation of how the writer solved being alive. That's the last thing that is nihilistic. I think what the reviewer meant was that for her, my freedom of cut and paste, for her, robs or drains the world of meaning. On the contrary, I would say it restores meaning to the creative act in a digital age.
I'll tell you what I thought as I read it. I thought, here comes another funeral dirge from the newspaper industry, which wants us to believe that culture and the country, maybe all civilization, are dying just because the New York Times seems to be dying.
Yeah.
I mean, the New York Times used to be the place where bestsellers were certified. If you didn't get reviewed in the New York Times, you were dead, and they could puff a book too. But suddenly the authority is being democratized, spread out all over the world, all over the globe, by real readers, and Michiko can't stand it.
I did feel like somewhere in the universe there had to be a cultural authority pushing back against it. Obviously, the Times has a unique position in many ways, almost in Western journalism, where in American culture, it used to virtually set the agenda of what the news of the day was. It's what the three networks followed. It's what other papers followed. It's what the AP followed. It's what NPR followed. And that's increasingly not the case. And on the one hand, the Times is making gestures toward the web and digitization. On the other hand, the Times no longer has anything remotely like the cultural hegemony that it once had. And I think this was such an uninflected argument, a kind of whine, I found.
That takes care of that. I think we're back in sync. I've been thinking, why not give credit to the people who write wonderful things? I mean, whether it's Melville or Emerson or anybody else for that matter. Part of the joy of it, seems to me, of quoting people is remembering the context and associating with the people that you're lifting from.
All good points. First of all, I would say, of course, I do quote them ultimately. In the back of the book are citations. I mean,
But there's this air of protest about quoting them.
Right. The reason why is that, to me, the argument is quite coherent. To me, the moment that you cite, you domesticate the work. The moment that you cite, you position a work of nonfiction either as a work of sober scholarship or pedestrian journalism, And so much of the gesture of the book is to try to rescue nonfiction as art. Why can Finnegan's Wake be a tissue of citations and quotations without reference? James Joyce famously said, "I am quite content to go down to posterity as a scissors and paste man." James Joyce said that. Writers, visual artists, I mean, the 1812 Overture, buried within it is the French national anthem. I mean, writers, composers, and visual artists from the beginning of time have endlessly appropriated each other's work. It's only now in our extraordinarily literal-minded and litigious society that we absurdly have the lawyers telling the artists what they can create. Why can so many poems, whether it's Paradise Lost or The Wasteland, be a tissue of citations? But somehow when a work of nonfiction emerges, we somehow want to domesticate it and neuter it by giving it these rather dumbing down citations. It's crucial to me too, also, Chris, that the book is an argument for the excitement of work that renders the reader into a kind of vertiginous doubt by not being able to locate the work's genre. And in exactly the same way, I want the reader to not be able to tell who the speaker is. Is it Sonny Rollins? Is it me? Is it Schopenhauer? Is it some weird remix of all of us? So that just as I'm making an argument about genre as the best work taking place between spaces, so too I want the reader to experience that on a visceral level, not knowing who the speaker is. Also, crucially, sort of finally for me, I very much hoped and assumed that the book would be published without citations. There are enough famous lines in the book that I hoped any literate reader would recognize how much of it was quoted, and then would quickly go to Google, and that there'd be a kind of pleasurable reader participation, whereas I slightly regret the fact that I sort of ham the reader ultimately those citations at the back of the book. So there's a whole variety of reasons as to why I wanted no cites in the book.
I wonder, David, what you learn from your students, what they're reading, and whether any of the novels for young writers and readers impress you.
Yeah, I've learned a huge amount from my students. I teach undergraduates and graduate students at the University of Washington in Seattle. So I learn a lot by teaching work to them. I'm interested in who they're interested in. Dennis Johnson's a writer I really love a lot. I love Jesus' Son quite a bit. And they like him a lot. They like Raymond Carver a bit. Some of them like Toni Morrison. Some of them like Alice Munro. But, you know, it varies widely. But I feel what I love about them is their impatience, their attention deficit disorder, their hunger, their weariness with formula, their desire to have, you know, voice just command them, and how little the Dickensian model holds for 2010.
I think it's very generous and rather brave of you to lay your views so clearly on the line. And I'm very, very glad we had the chance to sort of follow up.
Thanks, Chris. Thank you very much. I hope I'm not, you know, shooting myself in both feet, but so be it. You know, I mean, one review of my book said something like, "It's about time someone said something this honest in print." I just feel we'll all be dead in 50 years, perhaps less, and here's our chance to communicate with each other. You know, bring the pain.
It sounds like our boy Waldo. Speak your mind. You can change it tomorrow.
Precisely. The sun rises and sets on Ralph Waldo Emerson.
In this room, it surely does. Thank you, David Shields.
Thank you very much, Christopher.
Paul McCarthy and Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till listeners add their two bits in comments on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.